to the 78th Womanthology podcast. My name is Fiona Tatton, and I'll be your host. Womanthology is the digital magazine and professional community powered by female energy and ingenuity. We champion equal recognition and reward for everyone, sharing opportunities, ideas, and a deep pool of collective wisdom, supporting each other to be unstoppable. In this, our Women in Mathematics episode, I speak with Jessie Randall, acclaimed poet and author of Mathematics for Ladies, a collection of poems exploring the lives of lost women of maths and science. Jessie's powerful collection of poems delves into the often overlooked lives of women who made significant contributions to the fields of mathematics and science. Jessie discusses her journey in uncovering these hidden histories and how she transforms her frustrations with historical inequities into a poignant and relatable narrative for contemporary women. A quick reminder that you sign up for the Womanthology newsletter by filling in your details on the front page of our website. That's womanthology.co.uk. You can also join our LinkedIn community by visiting linkedin.com/company/womanthology and find us on X, Instagram and Facebook. Welcome to the Womanthology podcast. We have with us today Jessie Randall, and she is the author of an amazing book of poetry called Mathematics for Ladies. Jessie, welcome to the podcast. How are you today?
Thank you so much for having me, Fiona. I am doing well.
Well, it is great to be speaking with you. So you're on international exciting mountain time and we're just on UK time, but we'll try and make the UK time a bit more exciting.
And yet to me, your time is much more exciting than my plain old regular 9 a.m. time.
Well, hopefully we will meet in the middle with
That's right.
your 9 a.m. and our 4 p.m.
So we'll have lunch. That's right.
So could you start, Jessie, by telling us a bit about your educational background and career to date?
I grew up in Rochester, New York, which might sound exciting to British folks, but in fact is far away from New York City, and once won a prize for being the most boring city in the United States. It was a nice place to grow up. I went to Columbia University in New York. I did want to get there, and then to library school at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, which is the northernmost part of the American South. And it was certainly southern enough for me. The insects were enormous. And now I'm a librarian. I'm the curator of special collections at Colorado College, a small liberal arts private college in Colorado Springs. I look after our old, rare, valuable, and fragile materials. And I sometimes teach a class connected with the history of the book. It's called The History and Future of the Book. It's a half credit every 2 year class, so it's a very tiny amount of teaching responsibility, but I love doing it.
Well, I'm sure you would be great at doing that. I'd be in one of your classes, Jessie, and I'd be a good student as well.
I'm sure you would. You would get an A.
Well, I like to think so. So tell us about your book, Mathematics for Ladies, and what made you want to write it? Where did the idea come from?
So I suppose I gave you my career background in terms of librarianship and did not mention, as I often feel like it's a secret side project, that I'm also a writer, but I have been writing since I was about 9 years old, I think. We had a poet in residence at my elementary school, one of those programs, and I never stopped. Right around that same time, so I'm 9 or 10 years old, I got interested in Elizabeth Blackwell, the first woman doctor. My library in elementary school had a whole section of biographies, and they were alphabetical by the person, the subject of each book. And I guess I was a little bitty feminist at the time, because I remember being really irked by the fact that there were so few biographies of women. You know, there were probably, I think it was a set, I looked it up later, and it's like a 200 volume set of biographies for young people. And I went through and read all the ones by women and a couple about men. I read Benjamin Franklin's, for example. But I remember Abigail Adams. Okay, we'll do her. And then Elizabeth Blackwell followed soon after. And her life was so fascinating to me. She had become a doctor specifically, deliberately, because it would be hard. It wasn't so much that she was, at least according to this biography, and others, now I've supplemented my reading, She really chose it because she wanted to do something that was really, really difficult. And indeed it was. Her life story would make a fantastic movie, an opera, a musical. It would be really fun. You could call it Elizabeth exclamation point, something like that. So I really loved this idea of a young woman in the early 19th century just deciding, I'm going to do this impossible thing. So I was always interested in her, to the degree that my friends used to make fun of me because I would find a way to bring Elizabeth Blackwell into any conversation, write about her for any homework assignment, you know. So as I became more of a poet, as I got older, I wrote about her. And then what happened is I went to a talk about an astronomer, a star cataloger named Sarah Frances Whiting. There's a physics professor at CC, or there was, she's retired now, Barbara Whitten. And she gave this talk about Sarah Frances Whiting. And in the talk, she mentioned another cataloger of stars, Annie Jump Cannon. Now, that was a great name, and I wrote it down in my notebook. And then I started looking into Annie Jump Cannon in particular, and I thought, this is a whole collection of poems. Just Annie Jump Cannon alone, she looked at these blurry pictures of stars and gave them identifiers and invented a system for describing their brightness, their size, and so on. And years later, decades later, she could still identify these blurry, I mean, they don't look like anything, but she could look at it and go, oh yes, that's B7492 or whatever it had been. And that just blew my mind. And it was like it just contained the poetry without me even really doing much of anything. Sometimes I think being a poet is just noticing things that are lyrical or weird or metaphorical in some way, and then writing them down. So then, because Annie Jump Cannon, she was part of this thing called William Pickering's harem, because William Pickering, the astronomer at Harvard Observatory, hired all these women to do the work with the stars. Now, some say he did it because they were cheaper. It's also possible he did it because they were meticulous and careful, and unlike his male hires, they actually paid attention and cared about their work. Anyway, there were so many women in that group, and that led me to more women and more women, and then pretty soon I could not stop, and I just was on fire. This was around 2016, when things in America were happening that made me feel like I needed to do something, anything, for women's rights. Now, writing poems may not be the most powerful thing I could have done, but it was what I could do, and it made me feel a little less hopeless and helpless at that time. And eventually, I had so many that I thought, well, this could be a book. And around that time, I saw that Gold SF, the printing arm of the University of London, so Goldsmiths London, was starting up a feminist science fiction imprint. And I thought, well, clearly I need to try them. And they were so great. They said yes quite quickly compared to most places that you send your manuscript off to.
Because you were so good.
Or maybe they didn't get a lot of feminist science fiction submissions right away. I'm not sure. They now have done several books, and they're all terrific, and most of them are novels. Mine is the only poetry collection, at least so far. But they were wonderful. I loved working with my editor, Susan Kelly. It's been a joy from the beginning to now. And they're going to publish a sequel to Mathematics for Ladies in 2025.
Yay, coming soon.
Yeah, you don't usually get a sequel.
Coming soon to a bookstore near you. I like it for 2025. We will be right there. So consider us signed up supporters for 2025.
Oh, thank you. Great.
So make sure we get to hear about
it. I will.
When it's coming out. And what were the challenges that you faced in merging these two seemingly disparate subjects like poetry and maths?
To me, they were so easy to smush together. And in fact, the more I wrote and researched, I felt like, why hasn't anyone done this before? There are some wonderful books about women in science. You can read small biographies, maybe with illustrations, maybe for children, maybe for adults. They're wonderful books. My bibliography is very long, but writing the poems was often the easiest part. Maybe the hard part was feeling the feelings of anger and frustration and just wishing I could go back and talk to these women and tell them someday you are going to have a comet named after you or a crater on the moon, or they're going to posthumously give you prizes. But in their lives, they got very little recognition, almost always were ignored or were hidden, like sometimes deliberately hidden, where their name would be wiped off, as I'm sure you know many stories like that. So that was the hard part to me.
So it's kind of about righting that wrong almost. And in the same way as with womanthology, really, that was part of what made me want to reach out
yes.
and speak to all the people I was speaking to this, because I'm like, hang on a minute, there's amazing women everywhere. So
yes.
Kind of just, the word on the street is, oh, we're really short of amazing women. There's
no, amazing we're women. Really not. I thought that I would run out at some point. I've done 2 books now, and there are still at least 100 names on my list of possible subjects. And that's handpicked from a much longer list. There were so many women who wanted to do science so much that they sacrificed their private lives, they sacrificed marriage, children sometimes, they died young frequently. This was not an easy path to take. In fact, the title of the sequel to Mathematics for Ladies is The Path of Most Resistance, which is a phrase that Neil deGrasse Tyson uses about the path for people of color and for women trying to get into STEM fields. It's not easy to be a scientist, period. But when you face discrimination, which can run from simply not being allowed to go to school for what you want to study, to something as simple as being told you can't be hired for a position on the science faculty because the science building doesn't have a women's bathroom.
Oh.
And I mean, it's so circular. Like, yes, the science building doesn't have a women's bathroom because you all have decided it doesn't need one. It's time maybe put one in, or, you know, there's other solutions here. Anyway, you can tell I get so mad. But you have to do something with that anger. You can't just sit in it. I mean, you have to sit in it all the time. You have to get it. You have to find a way to do something with it that is not just exploding.
Yeah, so I started a magazine and a podcast, and you
yes.
write these books, these amazing yep. books.
Well, thank you.
So do you have any particular favorite poems or particular favorite lines from the collection that are special to you?
You know, that's the best question you can ever ask a poet. I will read, all the poems are quite short. Here's a poem that connects with what we were just talking about. This is Charlotte Angus Scott, born 1858, died 1931. When I was at college for mathematics, I attended Cambridge lectures from behind a screen, of course, so the male students wouldn't see me. I might have distracted them. And so I had to picture all the numbers in my head. I had no view of the board. Maybe the strain of all that imagining is why I tied for 8th place on the exam. Being female, I was not allowed to attend the ceremony, nor could my name be read aloud. But when the list got to 8th place, the men called out, "Scott!" and cheered and waved their hats. Or so I'm told, I wasn't there.
Blimey! Oh!
Ooh, blimey! I like that as well.
Sorry, I went very Dick Van Dyke there in Mary Poppins. I don't know how they're blimey.
So there's a case where Scott, because of the trouble she faces trying to study math, she actually becomes a better mathematician. So there, patriarchy.
Yeah, come from behind a screen, and she's not allowed to look at the numbers.
Right? I know. I mean, there's no Title IX. There's no equal access for men and women to education, and men are the ones who matter, and so you have to protect their education, and women are just kind of extra and can make do.
And she's behind a screen because she's going to distract them with her attractiveness.
Being female, probably.
Well,
I don't know what she
looked like.
Her femininity
was like, surely your femininity might ooze from behind
yes,
the screen.
Yes, like, maybe. Oh no, breasts. They'll never learn math again.
Everybody needs to read this book now. just for I think you've really demonstrated in one poem.
I want to say 70. There are 70 women in the book. Most of the poems are just a page. Obviously, I'd love everyone to read it for any reason they want to, but I don't know about your schools in England. In the United States, we're starting to improve, but there's this idea that only men can invent things, that only men are worth studying. You know about Thomas Edison and you know about Albert Einstein. I haven't done this in a while, but there was a point where if you typed woman scientist into Google and chose images, what you would get was a sexy lady scientist Halloween
like stock
costume.
Images. Yeah, sexy scientist. Yeah,
yeah. Or a costume. It was a Halloween costume.
Yeah.
So I would really like to see that change. There are so many interesting women. I mean, there are other ways to do this, but you could ask everybody in the class to look into these women further. The little bite-sized poem is good for short attention spans. And then if you get curious about somebody, you can look up more. That's the nice thing about writing poems in the internet age. You don't really have to put a lot of footnotes and explanations. You can be very succinct. You can let people, if they want to, they can find out more, but you don't have to push it on them. And I love that about poetry.
Well, this has made me want to find out a lot more. So count me in.
Oh, thanks.
And in terms of readers, what would you like them to take away from the book?
Oh, gosh. You'd think I would have an answer to that question. I want people to be curious about these women, and I want them to feel hope, I suppose, that there are women in this book that did really important things that almost no one has heard of. I understand that in England, Mary Anning has now become part of school curriculum, which is so wonderful. When I read Mary Anning's poem in the United States, most people do not know her.
And she's got a statue now as well.
Yes, I do feel hope. I feel like we are opening up our minds to the idea that there might be more than just Thomas Edison. I mean, there's almost this idea that Benjamin Franklin somehow invented electricity rather than discovered it, you know? Like, women were there all along, sometimes disguised as men, sometimes, you know, the wives behind husbands, sometimes just quietly doing what they can and not being recognized, you know, till years after their death, decades. I have a very specific hope. One is that some Hollywood producer will read about Elizabeth Blackwell and decide she needs a movie.
Hollywood, are you listening?
And the other is that in the new book, there's a poem about a Black woman who was the first meteorologist in the world. You know, she had a meteorology degree and she got hired to do the weather at TV station in Buffalo, New York. Why? Because her predecessor got arrested for robbing a bank. And I feel like this is clearly a fantastic movie starring perhaps Leslie Jones. There are many other great actresses who could do it. It would be so funny and all true. It could have one of those statements at the beginning, you know, based on a true story.
Maybe Netflix will make it.
They should. They make everything else. Let's have a whole series. That could work. Like a whole series. It could be called Mathematics for Ladies. And there'd be 10 episodes. And I could recommend who would be chosen.
I think we've got an idea here.
We're going to get rich, Fiona.
I think we're sorted here today, Jesse.
Excellent. That's it. We're done.
We're going to do that. Well, the frustration, but the people that I speak to as well. So the Mary Anning statue, I spoke to the woman who had been behind the statue and then her daughter was involved as well. And even the fight to get the statue and then the politics behind the statue and people going, No, we can't do that. Oh, no, and people getting in the way of just such a good thing to do and people making that difficult. So it's women like us having to be difficult women, aren't we? We're having to say, no,
right.
we want the statue. I'll be difficult. That's fine. We want this statue or we want this whatever. And it's just the frustration. And in terms of advice for aspiring poets, because I sometimes think, oh, maybe there's a few poems in me, but they're just still locked in there. But for aspiring poets, who are maybe interested in incorporating unconventional themes or subjects into their work. How do you kind of riff as a poet? What's a good way of, if you think there's a poem locked in there, how do you get it out?
You know, I've always written all kinds of poems since I was a kid. I find that it's really comforting if you can structure a poem on something that you have researched. So a fellow poet years ago used the term research-based poetry to me. And I thought, aha, that's the name for what I like to do. I like to find out things and then distill it down in some way to a poem. And sometimes that's just for me, to help me understand something that I'm interested in. It doesn't necessarily go any further than that. But I think writing any kind of poem is an amazing feat and also a cinch at the same time. Nobody's stopping you. It doesn't cost money to write poems. It's nice that way. You don't need special supplies. You just need your mind and something, some way to write. There's lots of ways. My advice, whenever I talk to creative writing classes, it might sound a little daunting, but I say you should be reading poems. Say for every 100 poems you read, you're maybe going to write one or two poems. So reading poems, and you don't have to read poems you don't like. There are a lot of kinds of poems out there. So reading them, writing them. And then for me, this research piece makes it more understandable. It gets down to sort of small chunks and you go, well, I'll just read about this person or this idea. And you don't have to write the poem the first day you think of the idea. In fact, my method, which I'm not saying is for everyone, is very, very slow. I'll work on a poem and then I will put it away and I try not to look at it for about 3 months. And then when I look at it again, it'll be quite clear, oh, that's not worth pursuing, or, oh, I need to fix this or that. I'm always surprised in writing workshops when people write something and then on the spot share it with the people in the room. That's a very common way of doing poetry. And it works for many people. But for me, that's horrifying. I don't want to talk about it until some time has gone by.
I like that. Put it away for 3 months. It's like a fine wine. It's kind of maturing. Mm-hmm. And then
you're working on the next one. It's not like you're just sitting there waiting, staring at the pot that it won't boil. You're working on something else. For me, the key is to always have lots and lots of things at different stages so that you can go back to what you feel like working on that day.
And I think what you're demonstrating as well is this. So is STEAM a big thing over there? Obviously with women in STEM and then women in STEAM. So
yeah,
the whole idea that to like STEM, you don't have to be completely separated from the arts,
yes,
and creativity and things
that's
like that.
Right.
And that, I think that's such an important message as well, because I think certainly it was quite a long time ago that I was at school. You'd be surprised to look at me, but it was quite a long time ago that I was at school. And it was very disparate and it was different paths. And I was always the more creative person. And had
yes.
there been STEAM and that kind of approach,
yes,
I probably would have stayed more involved in STEM.
But I think you and I both grew up at a time when there was, I mean, even today, women, girls are being pushed out of the sciences. They love science until they get to a certain point when they see that girls aren't welcome. I'll tell you a story. So my son, when he was in math class, between, I want to say, 7th and 8th grade, his class was half girls and half boys in 7th grade. In 8th grade, there were something like 2 girls in the class, and they were both thinking about dropping out. And so when we went in for the parent-teacher conference thing, and I said to the math teacher, so what are you doing about this problem where the girls are dropping out of math? And he said, I don't know what you're talking about. And I said, well, my son tells me there used to be, and I explained the whole thing. He said, oh, I hadn't thought about it. I hadn't noticed it. How can you not notice that and want to do something about that? I mean, maybe he was just sort of covering his own incompetence. I don't know, but it's happening everywhere. It wasn't just, this is just one anecdote of something that happens all over. And it's something the teachers and schools, you know, I, honestly, when I think about it, that happened around the time that I began the book. Like, that might be more what it was.
The trigger. Oh, this was a trigger.
You know, you've brought something up that I have not realized until now.
That was a spark.
Yes, that the idea that girls would think, oh, this isn't for me. And of course, the girls don't think I'm being pushed out by patriarchy or I should become a feminist. They just think, oh, all my friends have dropped out of this and the teacher doesn't ever call on me and this is hard and I'm going to do something where I'm more welcome. You know, there are ways we can mend that. There's talking of STEAM. I mean, these academic divisions are abstract, right? So there's a book by C.P. Snow called The Two Cultures that I read in college. And it's about this idea that science is over here and the arts are over there, the humanities. As though the arts have to do with being human and the sciences don't. And that this is a mistake. C.P. Snow says, this is not reality and we should stop thinking this way. And he, of course, gives ways to do that and so on. But certainly when I read about Elizabeth Blackwell when I was little, I thought, oh, I'll be a doctor too. That sounds cool. And somewhere along the line, my memory of it, the way I remember it, is that I had to dissect a frog at some point and I thought it was gross. And that was the end of that. Maybe that's true. And it's not like I wish I were a doctor right now. I love being a librarian. But librarianship is something that women are very welcomed into. It's usually not paid as well as jobs that are more male-centered. And I love my work, but I wonder if the choices were more fair, if there was more sense in a classroom that nobody should be denied a pathway because of their gender and many other things too, of course, that what a better world we would have. Not just like my personal, oh, I could have been a different thing, but if we had more women in medicine, if we had more women in the sciences, we would actually have a better world because they would bring their perspective to things. Maybe we would have, for example, better medicine around women's issues, women's bodies. In medicine, for a long time, all tests were done on men because women are too complicated.
Yeah, all of that stuff. Jesse, which social media are you on as well? If you want to connect.
I have an Insta and a, what do we call that thing? Threads. If anybody wants to get on my poetry announcement list, you can just shoot me an email. I'm easy to find on Google. I no longer do Twitter/X, so I'm not there anymore.
What's coming up next for you, Jesse? What are you looking forward to? What are you excited about?
Well, my son is about to graduate from college. My home life is about to be different. And of course, I've got this new book coming out. I'm working now. I'm thinking about a new big project. I don't like to talk much about a project when it's in this stage, but I'll say that I have done one thing where I started with a jump rope rhyme, I wrote a story that's based on a counting out rhyme, the kind of thing we used to do on the playground to decide who would be it. And now I've gotten interested in those counting out rhymes and jump rope rhymes and the hand clapping games and wondering where some of these stories originated and deciding that it's okay to just imagine and make something up about them. So that's where I'm, what I'm doing now.
Well, we are excited about this. We're excited about the new book as well. I'm saying the royal we, like I'm royal. We are.
We at Womanthology. Yes.
We Womanthology. But thank you so much for taking part in the Womanthology podcast. Jesse Randall, watch this space for the new book coming out soon.
Bye-bye, Fiona.
Thank you so much, Jesse.
Thank you so much for having me. This was really fun.
In this section of the show, we hear about the contributors who have shared their stories in our new written issue. The stories include Carrie Liu, multi-award winning mathematician and founder of Hypatia Analytics, which she set up to strike a harmonious balance between corporate data science endeavours and philanthropic pursuits. Longtime friend of Womanthology, Carrie is also a council member for the Institute of Mathematics and its Applications, and she volunteers with a number of other organisations to mentor and support up-and-coming women in mathematics. Rosa Zuzi is Executive Director of the Institute of Mathematics and its Applications, the IMA. The IMA has a membership of over 5,000 mathematicians across different sectors, and its mission is to advance mathematical knowledge and its applications for the public good by promoting collaboration, innovation, and excellence within the mathematical community. Roz is leading a charge of dynamic female mathematicians who are going all out to highlight that women have a pivotal role to play in careers in mathematics and data science. And finally, we feature another longtime friend of Womanthology, Dr. Charles T. Gray, who is a musician turned mathematician and data scientist. Charles started out in Australia and is now based in Copenhagen's gaming industry, where she and her team revolutionise her company's understanding of data with their insights. She explains why working in the video game industry is a dream for her as a passionate gamer. Do check out our website, womanthology.co.uk, to read the full stories. Sadly, that's all we have time for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. And remember, if you want to support what we do, then share the link for the show on social media and also follow the show. Your feedback is really important, so please do rate and review the show in your podcast app. Join us for the next podcast episode and written issue, where we continue our long-standing collaboration with the Women of Soapbox Science.